Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Over 7 years, the HORN program at the University of Delaware has worked to guide aspiring entrepreneurs.
Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to teach you how to start a small business. Rather, it's about how you take an idea, how to take something that's your passion and turn it into something real.
Contributor Larry Nagengast looks at how the HORN program operates, its growth, and where it's headed. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also hear a local advocacy group's reaction to Pope Francis's new rule requiring priests and nuns to report cases of sexual abuse, and learn more about an exhibit celebrating 100 years of the Delaware State Fair. Plus, this week's Enlighten Me highlights award-winning student work from our Generation Voice Youth Media program. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Over the past 7 years, the University of Delaware's HORN program in entrepreneurship has seen good early results in its effort to serve as a springboard for promising startup ventures. Contributor Larry Nagengast recently spent some time looking at the program, how it works, and where it's heading for his latest piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he sat down with me earlier this week to tell us more about it.
For those who are unfamiliar, how did the HORN program get started, and in broad strokes, what is it trying to do? What's its goal?
Okay, well, HORN entrepreneurship defines itself as the creative engine for entrepreneurship education and advancement at the University of Delaware. It started 7 years ago when it was known as the university's Venture Development Center. And this was an undergraduate program intended to guide students into entrepreneurial careers. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to teach you how to start a small business. Rather, it's about how you take an idea, how to take something that's your passion and turn it into something real. Yeah, it could be a small business, but it could also be a new product developed within an existing business, or it might even be a nonprofit organization. But the key point here is the university is trying to show its students how to get ahead of the curve and to stay ahead of it in a rapidly changing world through collaborations, connections, communications, and careful analysis. The HORN program got a kickstart, and it got its name, through a $3 million grant from a UD alumnus, serial entrepreneur Charlie HORN. And since then, numerous Delaware entrepreneurs and businesses have added their own support.
And over its first 7 years, it's managed to expand a fair amount. How much more is it offering now than it did when it first started?
Okay. Well, you know, at first, the first thought the university had was, we're going to place this program within the Lerner College of Business and Economics. And that seemed logical enough. But HORN's director, Dan Freeman, lobbied to have a more independent status. So HORN was placed into the office of the provost, which is the chief academic officer of the university. And that has made it easier for HORN to work outside some of the traditional boundaries and to build programs that cross college lines. As a result, we've got students in more than 40 majors, including agriculture, engineering, education, liberal arts, and of course business, who can enroll in 9 or 10 credit certificate programs that blend their academic interests and personal passions with training that will help them use their creativity in the real world after they graduate. HORN also offers programming for graduate students. For example, there's a specialization in entrepreneurial studies that's part of the MBA program. And HORN's reach extends well beyond the university campus. By developing a curriculum in entrepreneurial studies that's specifically geared for high school students, it's helping to get students thinking about innovation and new career opportunities even before they start applying to colleges.
For the UD students involved, how does it work? What is it offering that's different from the typical curriculum?
Well, there are several ways that UD students can get involved in HORN, and it serves about 1,500 UD students a year. Some of them are recruited as freshmen into a 4-year program called Delaware Innovation Fellows. Others enroll into the certificate programs that I had mentioned. And HORN also sponsors clubs and activities that draw in still more students. But the key here is that we're not talking about a traditional education that consists of lectures and reading assignments and writing a term paper and then taking a final exam. The entrepreneurial curriculum is designed to help students take an idea and go and run with it. They learn not only how to write a business plan, but how to do the essential research, testing your assumptions, figuring out what works and what doesn't, plus the marketing, the financing, all the works that go into getting a business launched and moving forward. And the students are learning by doing, because Horn helps them make connections. It brings in mentors from Delaware's business community and beyond, and it also provides a lot of support as students work on these ideas to take them forward.
And it has had some notable successes. Can you give us an example of two of things that have come out of Horn?
Okay. Well, you know, when I talked to Dan Freeman, he rattled off several names. I'll give you a couple of examples here. FYB is a brand of handmade jewelry created by Alyssa Kukta, who's a UD psychology major. D150 Fueling is a local business that provides overnight refills of diesel fuel for commercial trucking fleets. Theravi is a company created by UD biomedical engineering graduate Amira Idris, and it manufactures a wearable vibrating device that minimizes phantom pain experienced by amputees. But the best story of all coming out of Horn is Carvertize, and that's the business that turns cars into moving billboards. Founder Mac Nagaswamy was one of the first UD students to enroll in the Horn program, and his partner Greg Starr soon followed. They took what they learned at Horn and they launched their operation by winning a few small contracts from local businesses and nonprofits. And you know, certainly many of us have seen these cars that are driving all over Delaware, wrapped with advertising promotional materials for state agencies and numerous businesses. And from there, you know, they've nailed down contracts with larger contracts with state government, and then they've grown. And they're now handling advertising campaigns in Philadelphia, in Chicago, on the West Coast. And they're working with prominent brands as well. Crayola, NASCAR, Sprint, Lyft, and even Amazon.
So after 7 years, has the program found any key ingredients to making the ideas developing there, you know, get the push that they need, or at the very least create an atmosphere to maximize the opportunity that Horn presents for success?
Well, you know, it's a little bit like Coca-Cola or McDonald's. You know, if they've got a secret sauce, they're not going to reveal all of the ingredients. But, you know, they've got a diverse programming menu, and we've talked about that a bit here. And that menu really has a very high nutritional value for budding entrepreneurs. And that's what's helped Horn catch on so well. As Mac Nagaswamy put it to me, you're around fellow entrepreneurial students who think big and who dream big. And being around that ecosystem helps build your own confidence.
But your piece does indicate the program is still, like the business ventures it fosters, trying to tweak things, improve things. What are some of the issues and challenges that the Horn program faces at this point?
Well, you know, one of the concerns expressed about Horn, it's not so much about its own program as it is about this, you know, the broader entrepreneurial environment in Delaware. I talked with John Brilliant, another serial entrepreneur. He's taught and mentored at Horn, and he's quite familiar with the state's business scene. And in Delaware, Brilliant says he still sees many silos, these business entities and others that tend to work independently rather than collaborate. Extending this line of thought a little bit, he believes that there are still a substantial number of businesses that are risk-averse. They're reluctant to take a chance by supporting and contracting with these startups, as the state had done with Carvertize. I mean, I'm not sure to what extent this is a Horn problem, but as Horn develops, it might be able to use its growing leverage to get Delaware businesses to become more supportive of the startups that are based in UD and elsewhere in the state.
And as you mentioned earlier, the program is now stretching beyond the UD campus into high schools, kind of expanding its footprint in that way. Let's dig a little deeper into what's going on there.
Yeah. Well, when the program got started, both Dan Freeman and Charlie Horn believed that if they were going to have maximum impact, students in high schools should have the opportunity to learn entrepreneurial skills, communication, collaboration, critical thinking. These skills are not only critical to entrepreneurs, but they're also essential skills for advancing in a society that's moving ahead far more rapidly than many of us adults can imagine. For this reason, Horn began developing an entrepreneurial curriculum appropriate for high school students. as it developed, they got students they got teachers at several Delaware high schools interested, and the classes have become an elective at several schools. I know William Penn High School, Ursuline Academy, Charter School of Newark, and a couple of others. Now, in addition, they took this curriculum and they posted it online, and that means that teachers all over the country could access it and use its lessons plans in their own classrooms. Further, recognizing that students everywhere, and we're talking about Delaware, we're talking about USA, we're talking about all around the world, may have an interest in becoming entrepreneurs, but might not be able to get that instruction in their own classrooms, they made this curriculum accessible to students as well. So, you know, essentially students can go online, find the Horn curriculum for high school students, and they can learn this on their own.
The program also uses competitions to engage students at the collegiate and high school levels, as well as others. Tell us a little bit about how these different competitions work to kind of get some, maybe a broader audience involved.
Well, yeah, there's nothing like a good contest to get students engaged. And so as the high school entrepreneurial curriculum was coming together, Horn also created what's called the Diamond Challenge, which has grown into an international competition among high school students. This year's participants came from 26 states and 40 countries, from as far away as China, South Korea, India, Pakistan, and nations in Africa and Europe. From Delaware alone, 47 teams participated in the challenge this year. The challenge has two tracks, one for business innovation projects and one for social innovation projects. It's a three-step competition, and the final round, which is called the Diamond Challenge Summit, is held on the UD campus in the middle of April. More than 60 teams participated in the summit this year. About one-third of them came from foreign countries. Now, the final round, it's really, really intense for the entrants. You know, it's a lot like the Shark Tank television show, but with a lot less snark and, you know, really a much shorter laugh track. Teams get 5 minutes to make their pitches, and then they get 3 minutes to answer questions from the judges. The topics, believe me, are really serious. It was really kind of mind-blowing to sit there and listen to what the finalists were talking about for a couple hours. Teenagers were working on projects like improving cleanup of oil spills, to identify when alcoholic beverages have been spiked with dangerous drugs, how to distribute surplus medications that would otherwise be wasted to low-income people who could not otherwise afford them, and how to develop batteries that would do a better job storing energy captured by solar panels. And you know, incredibly, with a good number of these projects, they've already applied for patents and they've gotten some outside financing to get these operations started. Now, at the college level, UD has its own competition, and it's appropriately called the Hen Hatch. It follows a format similar to Diamond Challenge, and it runs on two tracks. One is for UD students, and the other is for university alumni, faculty, and staff. There were close to 70 entrants this year, and the final round was held in late April at the Queen Theater in Wilmington.
And what did some of the winning entries in these contests yield this year?
Okay, cash and some valuable services as well. Each competition has an annual prize pool of $100,000. So we're talking some big bucks here for startup ventures. Now this year at the Diamond Challenge Summit, a total of $45,000 in cash prizes was awarded, with $11,000 going to the first place winners in each track. For Hen Hatch, $66,000 in cash prizes plus services was awarded at the finals. The first place student team for Hen Hatch had a project that uses drones and virtual reality technology to assist emergency services like firefighters and paramedics. They won $21,000 in cash plus 10 hours of services from an accounting firm and another 10 hours from a marketing firm. The faculty track winners, two math professors who have created a biotech corporation that's involved with cancer therapeutics, received $14,800 in cash, plus 10 hours of legal services and 10 hours of marketing advice.
Pretty impressive. Obviously, there's a lot going on with Horn. Ultimately, though, what is the program's measure for success?
Around Delaware, we've talked for years about the state becoming a hub for one industry or another. And John Brilliant points out that the nation's prime regions for innovative entrepreneurial activities are centered on one or more outstanding universities. Silicon Valley has Stanford, Boston has Harvard, MIT, and some others. John Brilliant's hope is that Horn can continue to expand and to nurture more and more new businesses, whether they're launched at UD or in our high schools or just about anywhere in the state. The point of Horn, he believes, is that it's a place where people can think freely, where they can let their imaginations soar, and where they can test whether their ideas are going to work. Some of them are going to succeed. More of them will probably fail. But Horn can still be a place where some dreams can become realities, and those that won't are those that will still be able to serve as valuable learning experiences.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nightingale for his time on The Green this week. You can find his piece on the University of Delaware's Horn Program in Entrepreneurship online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next, our Kelly Steele talks to the Beau Biden Foundation's executive director about Pope Francis's recent move to obligate Catholic priests and nuns to report incidents of sexual abuse and possible cover-ups. Stay tuned for that here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Last week, Pope Francis issued a new rule obligating all Catholic priests and nuns to report incidents of sexual abuse and any attempts to cover them up to church authorities. Reactions to the Pope's move are coming in from all over, including locally from the Beau Biden Foundation, which works to help prevent child abuse. And the foundation's executive director, Patty Daly Lewis, spoke with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele earlier this week, expressing skepticism about how effective this new rule will actually be in addressing the issue of abuse.
Patty, thank you for joining me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for letting us have a word in this situation.
Before we address Pope Francis's issue of that groundbreaking law, give us the mission and give us some background about the Beau Biden Foundation.
So our mission is to continue what Beau Biden did as Attorney General and to make sure that we protect children and confront abuse. Protect children from abuse, whether that is abuse by an adult or abuse by their peers. So we address both child physical and sexual abuse as well as bullying and sexual exploitation and harassment.
Now, the Beau Biden Foundation issued a statement following Pope Francis issuing his groundbreaking law. Thoughts on this new law coming out of the Vatican?
You hate to slap down when somebody believes they are taking an important step in protecting children. So to the extent that it's better than it was, that's great. The fact of the matter is, though, that we have statutes in every state in the U.S. and many nations around the world require the reporting of child abuse. And what really would have been the groundbreaking step is to say you are subjected to all civil laws regarding the abuse of children, and you will be a mandatory reporter, which means you will make a report to the appropriate authorities. I worry with regard to this statement because they set out a standard of whether a person learns, which, in the legal term would mean knows, is known to the person, or is a well-founded motive to believe, which is not the law here in Delaware. The law in Delaware is whether or not you have a reasonable belief. So we need to make sure that we're not confusing people with what to report. We don't want to make people in the position that are covered by this new ruling by the Pope confused as to what they're supposed to do.
But isn't that exactly what it is doing?
No, I think it's very confusing. If I were in their position, I would now be confused about, A, what I'm supposed to do, and B, what the standard is, because if you have, Delaware law is a reasonable belief, and this is a well-founded motive to believe. I don't know if they're the same. I don't know what that definition is. The other thing is, we are very careful to ask people not to conduct their own investigations for a number of reasons. So we don't want people, A, that are reporters, to run around and start asking questions to conduct their own interviews of victims or perpetrators. That's number one. Number two, this standard also puts in place, investigatory steps within the church, which, again, unless these are folks that are trained investigators, that makes me concerned. They don't know what they're doing, and it is not best practice to investigate yourself. And we've seen what happens outside the church. I mean, what happened within the church with their investigations is wholly despicable. But let's look at other organizations that investigated themselves. Look at the Sandusky case where they investigated themselves. It doesn't work. Look what happened in Michigan State when they're investigating themselves. It doesn't work. And it encourages people to protect institutions over children. And that's something that is highly concerning. The other thing is, I don't see, and maybe I missed it, but I don't see anything on sanctions for failure to report. So what if you don't report? What happens to you then? Kelly, I went to Mass on Easter Sunday at the Basilica in Washington, D.C. There were 10,000 people at that Mass. It was packed. It was six deep standing, and it holds 10,000 people. So there were more than 10,000 people there. And saying the Mass was Cardinal Wuerl. Cardinal Wuerl, you may remember, was at one point the cardinal in Pittsburgh. And he's also acknowledged that it slipped his mind to report an instance of child abuse. He admitted it. After he denied he ever knew anything, he then later admitted that he was aware and it slipped his mind. So what message does it send to the 10,000 people in that church that day that someone who knew and failed to report and allegedly had resigned and was being replaced, like I think back in October, is saying Easter Mass at the Basilica?
We're talking to Patty Daly Lewis. She is the executive director of the Beau Biden Foundation. The mission of the Beau Biden Foundation is that child abuse can be prevented through effectively educating adults and children, developing the next generation of child welfare professionals, and also strengthening child protection laws around the country. This new law announced by Pope Francis makes the world's 415,000 Catholic priests, another 660,000 religious sisters, mandated reporters. The law does not require them to report to police, as victims have demanded. The Vatican, Patty, has long argued that different legal systems in different countries make universal reporting of the law impossible, and that imposing one could endanger the church in places where Catholics are persecuted minority. Continuing thoughts on this matter?
Well, first of all, you can certainly create a standard that says you follow the law of the jurisdiction you're in, and if that law does not require you to report to authorities, then you need to report up the chain. But we just know what reporting up the chain has done. We have seen it. It has harmed thousands and thousands and thousands of members of this church, of which I am one. And it has made a lot of people leave the church. I can't even tell you, Kelly, how many people say to me, as a child advocate, how can you stay in that church? How do you go to Mass? And my answer is, because when people like me leave, that's a real problem. And so I will stand and fight for the children of the church and the adults that have been harmed. And I will stand and confront the church to do the right thing, to make sure that abuse is, to the extent humanly possible, eradicated. And I'm just not comfortable that with no sanctions and no recognition of civil law in the nations that have them, we're sending the right message. I think it's actually maybe more confusing. Like, does this mean I don't have to comply with state law where there is one? Does this mean that if my state law says it's a reasonable suspicion, I now actually have to learn or have a well-founded motive to believe.
Has the Beau Biden Foundation been getting increased calls since this law was issued by Pope Francis a week ago?
Yeah, we have gotten a number of calls. I will say I've been out on the road talking about the problems of mandatory reporting and getting the right standard in place, making sure there's sanctions for people that fail to report, legitimate sanctions that mean something. And my staff tells me here in the office we've gotten a lot of inquiry about what this standard means, whether it's going to help children. And I know that individuals in other groups that are talking about the church recognizing the harm that's been caused to adults that are now coming forward, which is not unusual. Did the church take a supportive stand, right? So don't be the organization in states that are trying to extend their statute of limitations or eliminate their statute of limitations. Don't be the organization in Pennsylvania that fights it. Don't be the organization in the states that are changing the statutes, the organization that fights it. Be the organization that stands up and accepts responsibility for what has happened and says we will protect our children and we will protect our adults who were abused as children. You know, that's the word that needs to come out of this church, not we fight every single law that might hold us responsible. That's not a healing move. When you're the organization that holds itself up as, you know, the pinnacle of good behavior, to implement practices that are not best practices is very confusing.
The official statement released by the Beau Biden Foundation was, quote, "Child abuse should always be reported to trained professionals. All organizations should require their staff and volunteers to report suspected abuse to the local child abuse hotline. As we have seen time and time again," the quote goes on to say, "when suspected abuse is reported internally to supervisors, organizations are protecting their own reputation rather than protecting the children." That was the official statement released by the Beau Biden Foundation. Final thoughts on this, Patty Daly Lewis.
Yeah, we are sorry that we can't get into these churches and do our Shield of Protection initiative, because we want to step up and work with the churches to protect children, to make sure they understand the laws, to make sure they understand what to report. We do believe that all child abuse allegations, reasonable suspicion, needs to be reported according to the statutes, and it needs to be reported to trained professionals, that we should not have people that are part of an organization conducting an investigation with regard to children within that investigation, within that organization. We know that it's harmful to children for people that are not trained to interview them and investigate the situation. We know it's harmful to investigations when the police do ultimately get involved. To put children through multiple interviews is not best practice and is not what the church should be doing, in our opinion. We want to work with the church to help them meet best practices, to educate their staff on what best practices are, and to implement those best practices to protect children.
One last question. With your organization, the Beau Biden Foundation, are incidents of reporting child abuse going up or down over, let's just say, 3 to 5 years?
Well, we're very grateful that they're going up, and I know that sounds unusual, but the fact of the matter is Delaware now leads this nation by a large percentage on training its citizens, its police officers, its teachers to protect children, to prevent abuse, to make mandatory reports where required by law. And we know that as a result of our doing this training from the time Beau Biden was Attorney General until we have people out training today, we know this. People are reporting. And so I know for some people, they say, you know, it's getting worse. The problem's getting worse. It's not getting worse. It's actually getting better. When people report and proper investigations can be conducted and children can be protected, then it's getting better. It will go up. It has gone up substantially in Delaware in the last probably 8-10 years. It's quadrupled. But the fact of the matter is that means more kids are protected because people are calling.
Thanks to the Beau Biden Foundation's Executive Director, Patty Daly Lewis, and our Kelly Steele for their time on The Green this week. And Kelly rejoins us in our next segment offering more on an exhibit looking back at 100 years of the Delaware State Fair. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Memorial Day and the unofficial start of the summer season are just a week away. And what would a first date summer be without the Delaware State Fair in Harrington? This is a big year for the fair as it celebrates its centennial. And the Delaware Public Archives is helping the State Fair mark its 100th anniversary with a new exhibition called The Delaware State Fair, A Century of Family Fun. Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele spoke with Delaware Public Archives Director and State Archivist Stephen Mars about this new exhibition.
Steve, talk to me about the grand opening of a new exhibition celebrating the centennial of the Delaware State Fair. What's this collaboration all about?
Well, this is a wonderful exhibit that we opened last week, and it will run through the end of September. And it's the Delaware State Fair, 100 Years of Family Fun. And in this exhibit, we have historical photos and documents and artifacts that tell the story of those 100 years. Working in collaboration with the leadership of the Delaware State Fair, who have lent us some of their artifacts and materials, and we have them on display for people to come in and see and enjoy.
And when can they do this? During what days and hours?
During the regular business hours, Monday through Friday, and on Saturdays, we're open as well. And it's in our lobby, and what they'll be greeted with is a 100-year-old riding horse from the carousel. And it's absolutely beautiful. You will visualize that and see that when you come in. You can't ride it because it's 100 years old, but it is an antique and it is beautiful.
Why is this collaboration so important?
Well, it's good as a collaboration, as you say, because it shows something that is unique to Delaware, and that is the State Fair. And to be able to showcase that and the 100 years of history at the Delaware Public Archives, which contains the historical records of the state of Delaware, it was a wonderful collaboration. And when you come here, you're going to note this whole exhibit with a Delaware State Fair environment, I'll say, because we have the artifacts and the materials displayed just like you would be walking down the center of the State Fair itself and seeing all the vendors on the left and the right. That's the way we've projected this fair so that it looks welcoming and that people can really just enjoy themselves and walk around and look at the materials just like they would be walking around the State Fair.
I've got to get over there and see that. I'm sure it's pretty fantastic. I'm sure you'll get a lot of people through there.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to having individuals come here. We also have ready for them, as the archives, a series description of the plethora of materials that we have that do document the history of the State Fair. We have photographs and we have pamphlets. We have brochures of the events. In fact, what we gave out on the first day of the opening was the program guide from 1920. And what a guide that was. It showed all of the awards that were being presented, as well as the businesses from Harrington that supported the fair at that time.
Oh, wow. I would love to have one of those. Is this the first time that you guys have partnered, have collaborated with the State Fair on something like this?
Yes, it is. And that's why we thought it was so thrilling. You know, I had been introduced to the State Fair from former Senator Gary Simpson. He called me about 2 years ago and said, Steve, we're getting ready to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Delaware State Fair, and I want you to be on that committee as we begin preparations. And I've said I was honored, Senator, but I did have to admit to the good Senator that I had never been to the State Fair.
And wait a minute. You have never been to the State Fair?
Well, up until that time, after I mentioned it to Senator Simpson, and there was a long pause, he did say, well, that's going to change. And with that said, I am so happy to report that this year was my first year to visit the State Fair after living here for almost 15 years. And they had to try to pull me away. I was just mesmerized. In fact, I fell so much in love with one of the goats that I wanted to drag it out of the fair and bring it home. But of course, my homeowners association would have evicted me from the neighborhood. But nonetheless, well, because there was a bonding there. Because when I was a kid, I actually used to ride a goat. We lived in New Jersey, and we lived next to a farm, and I used to ride a goat. And when I saw this goat, it was big and had these big horns. It was everything that I really related back to. So I'll tell anyone that'll listen to me that you need to come see this beautiful exhibit that focuses on the 100 years of history of the Delaware State Fair, and you'll see a memory, I'm sure. You'll share a memory, and you're going to be certain to visit the State Fair to make a new memory based on the things that you'll see here at the Delaware Public Archives.
All right. I'm going to make it a point to come over there, and I really do want a program from, you said 1920?
From 1920. You know what's going to be so neat? When you look into the program, you're going to see some of the business sponsors from Harrington and the names. One of the businesses is the Dewdrop Inn. So you get the flavor of what the businesses were like in the 1920s. And they also have a full-page discourse on dentistry. So you have to just read that.
Okay.
it'll send you to a dentist real quick. Okay?
I don't like dentists nowadays. I'm pretty sure I wouldn't have liked a dentist in 1920.
So, but it's just great. And when you go through that booklet and you begin to see all of the awards that were given for all of these types of activities, from not only baking goods, but also for sewing and for horse racing and for stock car racing. But one of the important things that you're going to see when you come into the lobby is what we've found. We found in our vaults from 1947 a 16-millimeter film of the Delaware State Fair. At that time, it was called the Kent and Sussex Fair. But that film, which is, 70 years old, has been digitized now, and it is available to watch. It runs for about 12 minutes. People were spellbound in watching what was going on at the State Fair in 1947. So you got to take a look at that, spend 12 minutes, and you'll walk away with a beautiful memory all about the Delaware State Fair.
Well, I'm glad we had this conversation. You're just a wealth of information, and this exhibit sounds phenomenal. I will definitely get over to Archives. I haven't been to Archives in many, many years since I stopped working for Governor Minner.
You'll love this exhibit plus the other exhibits that we already have here with the Great War and the First State and the American Illustration Collection. I'll tell you, if you haven't been here in a few years, when you walk in this building, you're going to think that this is a brand new building in state government, that you just can't imagine what we have done. And we do these exhibits so we can present to the public what is important to them as far as history, but it also markets the various materials that we have in the archives that you can come and do research on.
Our thanks to Delaware Public Archives Director Stephen Mars and our Kelly Steele for joining us on The Green this week. And The Green concludes in just a moment with Enlighten Me and an award-winning piece from a Mount Pleasant High School student we're fortunate to work with in our Generation Voice Youth Media program at the school's radio station WMPH. Stay with us. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. In this week's Enlighten Me, we return to WMPH and Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District, one of the two schools we've partnered with on our Generation Voice Youth Media Project. Students there and at our other partner, WMHS, at McCain High School in the Red Clay School District, produce a bevy of interviews and features on a variety of topics throughout the year. And this year, features from students at Mount Pleasant swept the Radio Prepared Report category of the Delaware Press Association's 2019 High School Communications Contest, taking first through honorable mention. First place went to junior Sean Coulter, whose piece on teen jeweling also took second place in the National Federation of Press Women's National High School Contest. We aired Sean's piece previously on The Green, but figured award-winning work on an issue like this deserves another listen. The CDC reports that cigarette usage among middle and high schoolers has decreased in recent years, but e-cigarette usage has increased. So Sean delved into the danger posed by a specific brand of e-cigarette, the Juul, that has gained popularity at high schools like Mount Pleasant.
The health risks of cigarettes are widely known throughout American society, thanks in part to education campaigns throughout the 1940s and 2000s.
Then she lights his cigarette and he's all set. Set with a lifestyle that could lead to a heart attack. Ask your heart association how to reduce your risk of heart attack.
Cigarettes are bullies. Don't let tobacco control you.
But now, there is a supposedly safer way to enjoy your nicotine, in the form of a device that looks like a USB drive. These small electronic vape tools are called Juuls. Mount Pleasant junior Aaliyah says she thinks they're safer than cigarettes.
Probably better in a way, because although it has all those chemicals and stuff, cigarettes can, kill you faster.
But how safe are they? According to the Truth Initiative, one Juul pod contains 20 cigarettes worth of nicotine, and a pod only lasts the average Juuler 2 to 4 days. Juuls contain more than twice the amount of nicotine as other e-cigarettes, according to HealthyChildren.org. Nicotine is a highly addictive substance and can be especially dangerous to developing youth. I talked to a professional, Dr. Mark Felizzi, to see how true these statements really were.
Mark Felizzi, I'm an associate professor in the School of Social Work at Millersville University. I'm a licensed clinical social worker in the state of Delaware, Pennsylvania, and Maryland, and I hold a PhD in social work. Juuls tend to have a higher rate of nicotine. As a matter of fact, Juul pod has enough nicotine in it, has the same amount of nicotine as 20 cigarettes. So when you're taking a hit on a Juul, you're basically sucking in 20 cigarettes or a pack of cigarettes worth of nicotine.
Just like Aaliyah, many youth believe that Juuls are a safer alternative to cigarettes because it contains less toxic chemicals when, in reality, they can be just as dangerous.
Well, if you look at the fact that cigarette smoking in this country has decreased largely in part to education efforts, I think that Juuls are marketed and Juuls are viewed as something that's less addictive and less dangerous than traditional smoking. It's not always the case because you're getting a more pure form of nicotine.
While some believe the only harm in Juuls is addiction, Juuls also affect a lot of bodily functions. Nicotine has been proven to be harmful to brain development as well as being a highly addictive substance.
It affects the lungs, it affects the heart, it affects circulation. But also, since the human brain really isn't fully developed until the age of 25, with teens, specifically middle and high school students, you're looking at nicotine potentially affecting brain development.
Some of the misconception among teens might come from the industry's advertising. A study verified in the 2016 Surgeon General's report, e-cigarette use among youth and young adults, showed that 95% of Juul advertisements made explicit or implicit health-related claims, and some ads even featured doctors. Nearly all of the ads characterize e-cigarettes as cleaner and cheaper than traditional cigarettes.
And the counter-argument to that is, well, you know, a cigarette has formaldehyde, it has tar in it, it has other properties, you know, so yeah, that's true, but also in cigarettes, which are not healthy, obviously, they have a less concentrated form of nicotine. So I do believe that a lot of people, and the way it's been marketed, especially to the youth segment, a lot of people are going to think, well, this is a lot safer than smoking cigarettes. It's not, but the perception is out there that it is a lot safer.
The study also showed a majority of the ads said Juuls help users stop smoking. And, according to the CDC, 7 out of 10 youth have seen ads for e-cigarettes or Juuls.
One of the issues was that it was marketed to this younger population, the flavors that they had used. So they'd used a lot of fruit-based flavors, and they had used a lot of flavors that they felt the youth market would enjoy.
The Truth Initiative reports that 43% of youth started vaping because of the appealing vapors that are advertised to them.
A Juul is like a vape. if it's in your pocket, it's like people use it, you know, a lot. Supposed to be used, intended for, like, you know, people trying to quit smoking cigarettes.
That's Will, a Mount Pleasant student who says he has been juuling for a few months. He says he can already feel the addictive effects of the nicotine.
I did do it because I thought it was cool, but now I just do it because I have to.
And juuls have become common in schools like Mount Pleasant. Because they do not produce a strong odor, they are small and look like a flash drive, and the smoke dissipates quickly, it is almost too easy to sneak them into schools and smoke them without teachers noticing.
With juuling, it's like you could just go in the bathroom, go in the stall, and a couple puffs might go up, but like no one's really going to notice it.
Will estimates that roughly half of the kids at Mount have juuls.
I'm pretty sure like you could walk down the hallway, and there will be 30 kids in front of you. 15 of them will probably have a juul, but at least half of them.
In regards to the prevalence of juuls among students, Dr. Felizzi said this.
Yeah, it's very prevalent. Juuls were introduced in 2015, and as of this fall, something like 36 million middle and high school students vape. Now, having done research, I would suggest that that's probably an underreported figure. I'll bet there's a lot more out there. So I would probably say that number could even be higher.
It's worse than cell phones. When you have to put up no vaping signs in the bathroom at school, you know there's a problem that needs to be taken care of ASAP.
Because of Juul's small size, students are able to bring it into schools almost undetected. Pair this with the quickly dissipating vapor, and students can be juuling, leaving everyone else none the wiser.
You know, I'm sure there are people in school today who could be vaping in class, and the teacher's not able to pick up on it.
The KBG at Mount Pleasant has historically worked to fight cigarette use among students. But last year, the group started focusing on juuls. Why the transition? Because cigarettes in youth and adults alike simply isn't as prevalent as it used to be, in large part due to education.
Smoking cigarettes now is not socially acceptable in any public place. And that took years of education. And I believe that's what you have to do in this case. I think people have to be educated about the addictive properties and the danger that vaping pure nicotine can cause, not only the human body, but the human brain.
Some anti-juul advertisements have begun circulating with hopes of reaching a teen audience and informing them about the dangers of juuling, while the FDA has begun banning juul flavors in an effort to reduce the appeal to youth. But is it enough? What other factors about juuls are harmful that the FDA may not be aware of or controlling?
As a matter of fact, juuls in this country have a higher rate of nicotine, higher concentration of nicotine than any other country.
One of the reasons behind this lack of regulations is that juuling is new, and it's something that the government did not expect to be so popular.
This caught the government by surprise. I don't think that they thought that this was going to be as prevalent or as popular as it is. And I think it really, the FDA even admitted it caught them by surprise.
E-cigarettes are new, and people are uninformed. And as time goes on, more and more information, such as this piece, will circulate and hopefully raise awareness to the dangerous aspect of juuling.
So people say to me, is tobacco addiction really something? Is nicotine addiction really? Yes. There is a tobacco use disorder, and it's characterized by folks who technically become addicted to nicotine.
Even Juul Labs warns on its website, if you don't smoke or vape, don't start.
Thanks again to Junior Sean Coulter for his award-winning piece. And a reminder that stories like this are part of Generation Voice, our collaboration with the Brandywine School District at Mount Pleasant High School and its radio station WMPH, and the Red Clay School District at McCain High School and its radio station WMHS. Our youth media producer, Sophia Schmidt, oversees Generation Voice for us and worked on pieces like Sean's with teacher Paul Wishengrad, who runs the career pathway we work with at Mount Pleasant High School. And that's all we have for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head over to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributor Larry Nagengast, Mount Pleasant High School junior Sean Coulter, and Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.